Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Everyday life brings trials and tribulations that test the true metal of our very being. Few have experienced this more intimately than our guests this week. Jeff Henderson overcame a decade in prison before triumphing as star of the Food Network's Chef Jeff Project. New Orleans' favorite Irish chef, Matt Murphy, almost died from a flesh-eating bacterial infection just as he was about to add a newborn daughter to an existing brood of 18-month-old quadruplets. And Molly Birnbaum was about to enter cooking school when a car accident robbed her of the sense of taste. We'll inspire you with stories of these special people as we join them on a journey from tragedy to triumph on this week's Louisiana Eats. At the age of 24, Jeff Henderson was facing a 10-year prison sentence for crack cocaine possession. Today, he's the highly successful Chef Jeff of Food Network Chef Jeff Project and the author of the best-selling Cooked, From the Streets to the Stove. Chef Jeff, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Wow, thank you for having me.
So tell me how this whole thing started and how'd you end up in jail in the first place?
Well, you know, it's a long story. It's a long journey. I'm 47 today. I thank God that I lived to turn 47. I grew up in a traditional family, African-American family in my neighborhood. Many of us young men didn't have fathers. You know, my father and mother divorced when I was young, and many of the role models became the hustlers, the drug dealers, the slicksters, the guys who stood on street corners who manufactured dreams. And my dream was to make money to help my mother, you know.
And what neighborhood was that?
South Central Los Angeles and in San Diego.
And so then what happened?
Well, you know, I got in with the wrong crowd, a bunch of folks, and was influenced by some guys and started selling drugs in the mid-80s. Marijuana in high school. I didn't value education. I came from a family that wasn't educated, but hardworking and honest, good people. And I made the choice, you know, to say, you know, I want my American dream now and I want to help my mother. So growing up in poverty, you know, and we see our mothers struggle, you know, frustrated, working two jobs, three jobs. You know, I had to figure out a way. But, you know, it's not the right way. You know, it was a poor choice because the end results are people who get affected by drugs and crime.
So you went to jail. And many people find Jesus in jail, but you found food. Tell me how that happened.
Well, I actually found God and food in prison. I also found my potential and purpose in prison. And, you know, I don't like to put a lot of emphasis on prison because prison is a place that we don't want our young people to go to. But for men and women who are incarcerated, it's a moment and a period of time to reflect on your mistakes. And in prison, food was that vehicle, education, and my spiritual calling. Came all in the same prison cell, prison kitchen.
Well, I'm really fascinated that, you know, you went into prison a drug dealer, but somehow you came out after cooking crack to cooking foie gras. And that is really a big jump. So where'd you get those chops?
Well, you know, it's funny because I was in a federal system. In a federal system, the food was pretty decent. And I was inspired by a guy by the name of Big Roy and Friendly Womack, who were chief inmate cooks. And let me tell you, I never dreamed of becoming a chef ever in my life. I wound up in the kitchen through a bad situation. I was fired on my job in prison and put in the kitchen on pot and pan detail. And I realized the guys who work in the kitchen got the extra bananas, the extra chicken, the extra whatever it was on the menu, you know. And I just had a love for it. They taught me. I was fast. I was quick. And 6 months later, I became the head inmate cook at Nellis. And people began to praise me for my food. And it felt good, you know, for the first time when someone said, Jeff, the mashed potatoes, the eggs, the hash browns, you know, seasoned perfectly. And, you know, golden brown. You know, we had butter, we had salt and pepper, and a few other little seasonings we were able to get our hands on. No fresh thyme or rosemary, though.
So you come out of prison.
Yes.
What's your job out of prison? What happens
next? Well, my first job was throwing trash. I did have a plan. My counselor in prison gave me an article in the USA Today written by Jerry Shriver about the top African-American chefs in the country. At the time, it was Patrick Clark, Marcus Samuelson, and Robert Gatsby. Robert Gatsby was opening a 77-seat eatery in Beverly Hills in Los Angeles, and I began to write all of them letters, and no one responded, you know, to my letters from prison. So I made my way to his restaurant after prison, and within about 45 days, he finally gave me a shot. And that was my entree into the food world.
That's really fantastic. I have a question that I really am always searching for the answer for. So your people are from New Orleans. You're pretty familiar with this place,
right? Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. My grandmother is from here, three generations, and my grandfather is from Mobile, Alabama, but he kind of grew up here, worked on the Mississippi River. My mother and father are both from here. So both sides of my family are born right here on North Roman, Pennison Street, Gretna, Marrero, and a couple of the wards here.
So you've spent a fair amount of time in New Orleans,
yes,
then, I suppose.
Yes.
Jeff, give me your opinion of why this is. You know, once upon a time, all of the great New Orleans chefs were black men. And now you can't find a black man in a New Orleans kitchen unless maybe he is washing pots and pans.
Yes.
What's up with that?
Well, you know, it's something that's going on around the country, specifically here in New Orleans and in the South. During the 60s, 1966, 67, the Civil Rights Bill passed. Many black people were able to get government jobs and get better jobs. So at that time, working in the kitchen was, you know, demeaning. You know, people didn't want to work there anymore. And then with the glorification of celebrity chefs in the late 80s, you know, in the 90s, a lot of American chefs, non-blacks, went around the world. They began to infuse and take food that many blacks, you know, and Southern folks created and took it to that next level. So now it's been tough because it's not just about cooking anymore. It's about running a business, building a brand and marketing and things of that nature. Back in the old days, we just loved to cook good food. It wasn't about being on TV or being praised. It's something that we did naturally, historically in this country.
Tell us about your food. What is it that you like to cook, and what type of cooking is it that you're really known for?
Well, I was first known for world-renowned prison cuisine. Then it changed when I got out of prison, and I began to embrace California French cuisine, which is a lighter version to classical French, progressive American kind of food. Today, I call my food like posh urban. You know, I put a Southern spin on my classical French background training. So, you know, I call my gumbo a Southern bouillabaisse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I prepare a little bit different. I don't put oysters in there. I put all the andouille, the hot sausages, the Louisiana blue crab, and I put chicken in mine as well. And so I present it a little bit different. I kind of make it sexy. So I call it posh urban. So what I do, I take fried chicken, and I may serve it on a $100 burner dough French china, the white tablecloth, you know, to try to bring a better look presentation to that, yes.
What's the genesis of the Chef Jeff Project? How'd that come about?
Well, interesting. After I went on Oprah and with my life story and Cook launched, I got a call from the Food Network, and they said, Chef Jeff, you know, come to New York and meet with us. And I went out there, and they said, well, you know, we love to do something with you, but we don't know what it is. And I said, well, you know, I'm not the kind of chef to stand there, stir and cook and smile, you know, like your Rachel Ray's.
And, the stand and
you know,
stir.
The godfather of TV cooking, Emeril Lagasse,
right,
didn't have the personality for that. I said, well, you know, let's do a show where we use food as a metaphor. You know, the power of food to change lives like it did me when I was in prison. So I said, let's take at-risk kids off the street who come from different neighborhoods, different economic backgrounds, and let's create a catering company called Posh Urban Cuisine and take these young kids, but not only teach them how to cook and teach them business, but teach them life skills, how to smile, how to conduct themselves, how to greet people and things of that nature. So it was a very powerful, moving docu-reality series.
You were doing some pretty lofty things in Las Vegas.
Yes, well, you know, Vegas was a stepping stone for me. It was a blessing in disguise. I came to Vegas in 2000, and many people said that I couldn't get a job and I wouldn't get a job being a convicted felon, a black man with no formal culinary education. But Caesar's Palace, you know, they looked beyond my past and judged me based on my cooking. But ultimately, I went to Vegas to work at the Bellagio, the Big B, the Bentley of them all, I call, because I've always zeroed in on, you know, building relationships with top talent. And it took me 3.5 years, and Bellagio finally gave me a second look, and I became the first African-American executive chef to run a restaurant on the history of the Bellagio.
In your book, Cooked, you talk about how your grandfather's gumbo figured into your early life. Tell us about that.
My granddaddy, you know, I always get choked up talking about him and my grandmother. But he was an amazing cook, amazing man. I learned a lot of business from him. And my grandfather never had a recipe. I've never seen him with a measuring cup or measuring spoons. He was a dump cook. And when I came home from prison, I was like, Granddaddy, I want to be a chef. Can you teach me? He says, boy, I don't have no recipes. You got to just get in here and watch me. And I studied him, watching him make his famous gumbo and red beans and rice and oyster po' boys and his famous bourbon bread pudding.
Bourbon bread pudding.
Bourbon bread pudding. So I kind of put a twist on it now. I call it chocolate s'more bread pudding. And a lot of times now I add king crab legs and chicken to my gumbo. And my grandfather, if he was still living, he would say, boy, you don't put no king crab in no gumbo or no chicken, you know. So he would clown me a little bit, but I know he would be extremely proud of me. So my grandfather was the one who, you know, when the holidays and the weekends went down, my grandfather was man in the stove. Yes.
And that first book, Cooked, yes. It's actually in Movie Talks, huh?
Yes. I went on Oprah, and a couple hours after the air, got a call from Will Smith, Sony Pictures, and they purchased the life rights to my story. And we're in script stage right now, and he's planning to play me. And it's, you know, I just been extremely, I just blessed and favored. And but I truly tie my success and all my blessings to my paying it forward. To giving back, fixing the wrong, not just of myself, but many, many men who've done things in our communities, African-American community, that influenced generations.
Well, I know you've written a couple of cookbooks, but your next book is called The Power of Potential.
Yes.
What's that about?
Well, The Power of Potential is an extension of Cooked. In Cooked, I told the story. And The Power of Potential, I'm giving strategies and principles and exposing, teaching young people about the traits of success, how to live the American dream. And my motto was, when I came out of prison, I said, if these people can live in the suburbs in amazing homes, what do they know? I don't know. So I built relationships. I had to build a brand. I had to learn to smile. I had to straighten up the way I walk. I had to get my hands manicured. I got my teeth fixed. I took makeup to cover my earring hole up. And I had to become a brand. I had to make the felony jacket, the street swagger disappear in order to get information, to get the knowledge necessary to bring about that change in my life, because it's all about the American dream. How do we get there? What are the steps? What's the strategies? What lanes that we have to be in? And I believe that everybody was born with God-given talent, God-given strengths. Is that you have to find your potential, your gift, exploit that, and you can achieve what anybody else can. And I always say, listen, the have and the have-nots, the only difference, we all put our pants on the same way at a time, one leg at a time. And the only difference between them and us is that they have access, knowledge, and information. And if you get that, then we can make that playing field equal, and we can achieve what everyone else has.
You're entertaining an idea of maybe making a move in New Orleans. You think that could happen?
Absolutely. I mean, I would be honored to have an opportunity to open up a place here, you know, in honor of my grandfather and our New Orleans Southern heritage down here. So, I mean, I'm definitely open. There's space for me, and I think I can do some amazing things. I've worked down here for many years with Cafe Reconcile. I spent 3 days up at Angola State Prison cooking and teaching and inspiring, you know, inmates up in there. So, I mean, this would be a right fit for me here. So I'm super excited. Everything I do is connected to the community and giving back, you know, because it's important that we pay it forward, especially the ones who have been successful.
Well, Chef Jeff, I can't tell you what an honor and a privilege it is to have met you. And I can't encourage you strongly enough to come back to New Orleans, come back to Louisiana. There's a huge army of folks needing a hand up here. So
I would be honored.
Come back.
I would be honored. Thank you.
Food Network star, author, and chef, Jeff Henderson. Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's Culinary Heritage Hero changed the shape of New Orleans French bread forever when he set out to help Martin Brothers Coffee Stand and Restaurant.
Real French bread is fat in the middle and pointed on the ends. And if you got the skinny end of the sandwich, you didn't get too much of a sandwich. Some people were getting big sandwiches, and some were getting the skinny ends of the sandwich. When my grandfather was a child back in Sicily, he used to stay around the bakeries there. That's why he wanted to become a baker. And he remembered they made the long, straight loaves of bread there. So he made some for the Martins, and they decided they were going to try it, and it worked out great.
This innovative new loaf was 40 inches in length and uniformly rectangular from end to end. The amazing new sandwich size was sufficient to feed a whole family, which was especially important during the 1929 streetcar strike, when Benny and Clovis Martin, former streetcar conductors themselves, promised every striking worker a free meal at Martin's as long as the strike went on. It's said that when one of the strikers would come through the front door of Martin's, the call would ring out, "Here comes another one of them poor boys," giving our now famous sandwich its name.
One of the things that happened, I wasn't around, my father told me about this. He had two top-notch bakers. They left, went to Baton Rouge, and they were going to make French bread, New Orleans French bread. Never could do it. They tried and tried. They came back, talked to my father. They tried things, and they never could find out what was wrong and how to make a loaf of bread in Baton Rouge. They would talk with my father. My father would try to help them out, and everything they did, nothing came to pass to make a good loaf of poor boy bread in Baton Rouge.
Today, the John Gendusa Family Bakery is one of only three poor boy bakeries left in New Orleans. But luckily, John Gendusa's son Jason is keeping the family tradition alive.
Future is my son. My son is in it. He's been in for 10 years now. And he's just about getting ready to learn how to make a loaf of French bread after those 10 years. Daddy's still got to show him a few things. But he's really getting down to the point where he can make a very good loaf of bread.
Congratulations to John Gendusa III. You and your whole family of bakers are our Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Heroes of the Week, recognized with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchens. I'm Poppy Tooker, and New Orleans Poor Boy Bread is real Louisiana Eats. After a short break, Irish chef Matt Murphy joins us to describe how he won a battle with a life-threatening illness. Stay tuned. Together on this week's Louisiana Eats, we're taking the trip from tragedy to triumph with amazing tales from food friends who have traveled that road before us. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. If you're a fan of the Food Network series Chopped, you probably saw Chef Matt Murphy's triumphant victory this summer. Matt won the big $10,000 prize on Chopped, but he'd already won a much bigger prize back in 2009 when he beat the flesh-eating bacteria that came very close to taking his life. The entire New Orleans food community came together back then to support Matt and his family in that harrowing time. And today, you'd never know the rugby-playing Irishman came so very close to death. After your illness in 2009, I would say that you are an expert in finding the gray cloud's proverbial silver lining. Totally. Would you tell us about that experience a little bit?
Yeah. Of course, I'd been working, and like any chef, you want to be successful, and I was working here and working there, doing some traveling. Arrived in and got up one morning to my wife. I actually have quadruplet girls, and I told her, you know, I feel really bad. I've been out traveling for about a week and a half, 2 weeks, and you've been looking after the kids. I'm going to feed them breakfast. So I was going downstairs with the kids, carrying them, of course. They're all babies. They're all about one and a half. And I slipped on one of the toys and bumped my knee. Hadn't got a clue that I had blood poisoning. And what happened was, with the blood poisoning that had incubated in my system, that bruise ended up festering. And the bacteria changed into what you'd call a flesh-eating bacteria, right where your, you know, that big dark bruise is. Mm-hmm. I had no idea this was going on. I had probably, you know, the doctors had said, the diseases, I said, you had already blood poisoning about 18 to 20 hours before that. You had picked it up somehow. So usually when this happens, I had necrotizing fasciitis, which is a death sentence. You know, they'll shake your hand and say, it's nice knowing you. You're in a bad way and we don't think we'll be able to save you. I had no clue. I had a wine dinner that night. I had chefs that needed to be talked to. I had plates that needed to be worked on and so on. I was going about my day's work, but my knee was swelling up and the pain, and then I couldn't even move it with the pain. I said, you know what, I better go see a friend of mine. So I went to see him. He couldn't figure it out. Went home. You know, I said, oh, I've been traveling. Maybe I'm just something that's worn out. And I twisted my knee. Ended up going to the hospital, to Ochsner. And then I don't remember anything.
You were in the hospital for how long in total?
About 6 months, I think.
Oh, my goodness gracious, Matt. You are the most amazing man, though, because once you got out of the hospital, you made such a trajectory back into the kitchen and into the picture of health.
Yeah. You know, the craziest thing? I was in a coma for 3 days. I woke up, and I could see my feet, and I could look down at my hands, although I had these skin, they had taken the skin off some parts of my arm where the bacteria was. I had to get skin grafts. But I looked down at my hands, and I said, man, I've got my hands. Well, I can still cook, you know? I can still cook. Sometimes that's what your, you know, career, your destiny, and I love cooking. So that was something I held on to. And I said, you know, I'm going to get back in the kitchen, and I'm going to be able to cook fast like I normally used to. One of the biggest things was my wife was having her fifth child.
I was going to mention that you did have a lot to live for, because aside from those quadruplet little girls, the sainted Alicia was about to have number five, huh?
Yeah. I was basically like a head in the bed, a head that just could move around. I couldn't move anything. So my main goal was to get back so I could be home. So when she went in to have her fifth baby, I could be there with the home help we had, but the girls would, hey, there's daddy, he's lying on the couch.
Yeah.
But he's there and I could be there with them, you know. So that was my main focus.
Whew. Well, I'll tell you what, you have a lot to be thankful for, and you really are the silver lining in the cloud. New Orleans.
I'll tell you, one day at a time. You know, you ever often hear that saying, one day at a time? Literally, at certain stages in this, I was like 1 minute at a time.
Yeah.
If I can get to the next 10 minutes and be still alive, that'll be okay.
I think you learned a lot about the New Orleans community through that experience, didn't you?
Yeah, they were phenomenal. They are a community. They look out for their own, and they, when they heard what was going on with me, first of all, you had the chefs, you know, and you know, chefs can change a lot. But all the chefs I worked with over the years got together to do a fundraiser. And then the community heard about this, and it was just one thing after the other. Like, you know, to the point where my wife said, you know, this is me. She said, we're okay. We have people coming over. I can get to the hospital because I have these people who are minding the kids right now. And people would just show up. They would send meals over. It was, I mean, the logistics behind this was unbelievable. And it was all done by just New Orleans people. And talk about community, this was it. This was, you know, the whole village was helping.
Well, you know, Leah Chase talks a lot about how much she owes the New Orleans community for having helped her rebuild her restaurant. Mm-hmm. You actually had to rebuild your body and rebuild your health. When you look at the New Orleans community and your place within the community, what's ahead of you to do?
You know, I'll tell you, when I did get better and I went back to work in the Ritz, one of the things I got hell for doing was always doing community events. But, you know, it was like I couldn't turn down anybody. Every time someone would come, you know, Matt, you know, we want to do an event like your fundraiser, blah, blah, blah. And I'd be like, cool, let's do it. Let's do it. Because, you know, there's so much need in the community. And lucky enough, I had a job that where I could say, yeah, okay, we're gonna have a cook go there. We're going to serve some soup and things like this. And you have a choice. You can be insular and you can just look after your own thing. Or you can say, you know what? Hey, this school needs some art supplies. And someone is doing something and you can partner with them, you know, and raise those funds that they normally can't. I've always focused on that as being, you know, good business and also being a good citizen and being someone that can, from your position being a chef, especially in New Orleans, you can get a lot of people to move to action on things if you support stuff, you know.
I always say that the one thing I learned after Katrina was that if something really bad happens to you, and sometimes bad things happen that involve your family, your neighbors, your usual support system, if you're lucky enough to be part of the food community, you're going to be okay because your food friends are coming to help you.
Exactly.
And I really, really believe that. That was Chef Matt Murphy with the terrifying tale of his 2009 fight for life. If there are gray clouds on your horizon, drop by the Irish House on St. Charles Avenue and raise a pint with Chef Matt. You'll travel on knowing that surely a proverbial pot of gold is waiting for you at the end of the rainbow. For our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week, brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The correct answer to last week's question, name the variety of Louisiana shrimp with a fall inshore commercial fishing season that opened this year on August 13th, is white shrimp. Spring in Louisiana brings brown shrimp, the sweet, smaller Gulf shrimp that's sometimes referred to as Louisiana gold. Late summer into early winter brings those bigger white shrimp. White shrimp are almost always available in offshore, federally controlled waters, but our special inshore early season catch from shrimpers who trawl our marshy shores is really something to celebrate. Now let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
Well, this past week, we certainly had a tough quiz. Our winner's response was laden with question marks, implying that she herself did not know the answer. But whether this was a shot in the dark, an educated guess, or simply irregular punctuation, she ended up winning. So congratulations to Lauren Witkin of New Orleans for taking home our prize. Send us in your answer for a chance to win.
Our lucky winner will be receiving 3 full-size bags of French Market coffee, including dark roast with chicory, and French roast. This week's question is, what is the name of the Food Network series that featured this week's guest, Chef Jeff Henderson? Send your answers to Louisiana Eats at WWNO.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, this week's question is, what is the name of the Food Network series that featured this week's guest, Chef Jeff Henderson? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to LouisianaEats at WWNO.org with culinary quiz in the subject line, and you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Food super sleuth Ian McNulty is also the author of the definitive guide for finding off-the-beaten-path fun in our delicious state. His book, Louisiana Rambles, is a no-miss. Ian, what have you hunted down for us this time?
Well, Poppy, today we're heading out west a little bit to Abbeville, a little town there to the south and just slightly to the west of Lafayette, to check out a place called Dupuis Oyster Shop.
Mmm, oysters in there, I imagine.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, Abbeville is famous for its oysters, of course, and this is one of the places that has helped cement that reputation that it has. Now, I have to say, I love going to Abbeville, and I love going there at this time of year, too, you know, just when it starts to get a little bit of fall. You can almost, you know, see the fall coming your way. Abbeville is a really cool town, surrounded by sugarcane fields, cattle ranches, and little fishing communities. And this time of year, you're starting to see, you know, a lot more activity in the cane fields. You're seeing those wagons that are going to be trundling down the road, loaded with cane, en route to the mills, including Steen's, which is, of course, that century-old, very famous maker of that pantry staple of the South, the Steen's syrup. Right?
Our historic treasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's right there in downtown Abbeville. You can see these huge, oversized Steen canisters that are double as the tanks for the plant there. And that's right down by the center of town, by the church, which, of course, is the heart and soul of this town, St. Mary Magdalene Catholic Church. And right across the street from St. Mary's is Dupuis Oyster Shop. Now, if you happen to go there on a Saturday, which is the last time I was there, Mass is in session. Everyone's sort of double parked around this church and around this square. It seems like the entire town is inside this church.
Vigil Mass.
Exactly, yeah. The bell rings. Everybody comes pouring out. Half of them get in their cars and drive away. And the other half, it seems, make a beeline right across the street to Dupuis Oyster Shop. So, no, I saw this and, like, hustled in as fast as I could to get ahead of the church crowd. And I'm glad I did. This is a great place. I mean, it really is kind of a landmark place. It's been in business since 1869. I mean, that's how far back it goes. And the story that they tell around Abbeville is that it started with this guy, Joseph Dupuis, who, was, they say, would pole up the river from Vermilion Bay with his oysters that he had just caught. And he would stop in Abbeville and set up shop on the riverbank there. And, you know, eventually this business led into a restaurant. Now, today, it doesn't really look like some sort of landmark historic restaurant. It really doesn't. You see this place in the street, it just kind of looks like any old small town diner kind of restaurant, really, you know. But you walk in, and then there's a nice terrazzo floor, and it's a little bit dark. There's a bar. There's oyster implements everywhere, and these, like, prize-sized oyster shells tacked up here and there that somebody dispatched. And, of course, the obvious sign of a good oyster bar in operation, the little parking lot around this restaurant is paved with oyster shells. And there's even this, like, great heap of them outside right on the riverbank that looks like something archaeologists would be exploring. It might even be visible from space. I'm not sure. So obviously oysters are the big deal here. Now, this is a full-service restaurant. They have steaks and tuna, seafood pastas, crab cakes, fried seafood platters, the whole run. But you're really coming here for oysters, and you can get them a whole different bunch of different ways. Oysters Rockefeller, and then what they call Oysters DeVille.
What is that?
Yeah, Oysters DeVille has garlic and herb butter and Italian cheeses all kind of broiled on there. And then probably my favorite, the namesake, Oysters Dupuis. That has crab meat stuffing, pepper jack cheese, and then it's all char-grilled. Really, really tasty.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah, it's a really interesting place. And like I said, it obviously has found a place in the hearts of the locals who flock there. And for people who are out exploring, you know, this part of South Louisiana, especially this time of year, it gets so beautiful and cool out there. It makes a great destination to go to. You know, if you do go there, keep in mind it's, you know, does lunch during the week and dinner at night. Only does lunch during the week, though, so you can't just stop in for a weekend lunch, unfortunately. But, you know, if you're in town, like last time I was there, and you see the crowds letting out of St. Mary Magdalene Church there in the middle of the town, you just better follow them right over to Dupuis and make sure you get a spot.
Ian, thanks so much for telling us about another delicious new spot in Louisiana. You ready to ramble?
Let's hit it, Poppy.
Louisiana Eats ramblin' reporter Ian McNulty. Don't go anywhere, because after our next break, we hear from author Molly Birnbaum about a life without scent and taste, and how she worked to recover those vital life pleasures. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Rouse's Markets. Reading Molly Birnbaum's new book, Season to Taste, made me stop and consider in a new way the nuances of taste and how scents bring us flavor. At 22, Molly had graduated from Brown University and was heading to the Culinary Institute of America to train as a chef. All that changed when she suffered a dreadful accident that resulted not only in broken bones, but the loss of her sense of smell. Molly, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the accident.
Well, I was working in Boston at the time, and I went for a jog one morning, as I often did. I was living at my mother's house at the time in Brookline, and I went for a run. I was jogging up the street and came to an intersection, a four-lane highway, and it had a light, and I, you know, thought it was the time to go, so I just went straight across. And I was hit by a car.
Mm. So when did you discover that you'd lost your sense of smell?
It took weeks before I discovered that I couldn't smell. And that was in part because I was injured in so many other places. I tore the ligaments in my knee. I broke my pelvis. I fractured my skull. I was not with it for a while.
Mm.
But a couple of weeks later, I was recovering in my parents' house. And my stepmother, Cindy, decided to bake an apple crisp. I was having a hard time eating. You know, I wasn't feeling well at all. And she thought this would help. It was one of my favorite desserts, you know, the apples and the cinnamon. It was fall time. It was, you know, reminiscent of my childhood. But when she took the crisp out of the oven, I was in a room with family and a friend or two, and everyone was oohing and aahing over the scent of this dessert. And I breathed in, and I couldn't smell anything. And I thought, you know, this is strange. Maybe someone's in my way, you know, maybe something was blocking the scent from reaching me. But when she took it out and brought it to the room and held it under my nose and I breathed in, I could feel the heat, the thick heat of the steam in my nose, but there was nothing else. And that's when I realized that something was truly wrong.
And what happened as a result of the accident was your olfactory nerves had actually detached, correct?
Well, what happened, I later learned, is that when I fractured my skull, and it was the back of my skull against the windshield of this car, so there was a big impact, a thump, and my brain bounced within my skull. And when it bounced at the front, it severed the olfactory neurons, which snake from the nose to the brain, kind of sheared them off with it, the impact, kind of like a lawnmower over grass. And so in one split second, they were just completely detached and no longer able to transmit these signals.
But they can actually regrow, right?
Well, that's one of the most fascinating things about the sense of smell, is that our olfactory neurons have the ability to regenerate and regrow. And even in a healthy nose, your olfactory neurons are constantly regenerating. You have new olfactory neurons. I've heard that in rats it's 30 days. I'm not sure what it is in humans, but it's relatively frequent.
Explain to us the complexity of how the sense of smell works in humans.
Well, it is complex, and it is one of the least studied senses, so there are still many questions left. But basically, when we inhale over an apple crisp, there are hundreds of scent molecules that enter in our noses, travel up to the top, and are received by the olfactory receptors, which then transmit signals from our nose to our brain. And these signals are patterns. You know, all of the different molecules send very different signals over many, many different neurons. And so it's almost like reading sheet music. The brain interprets these signals to be cinnamon or apples or sugar. And it's not entirely clear how we interpret these signals, but nonetheless, we do get that scent.
Well, tell me how the loss of the sense of smell affected your life.
It affected it greatly. When I lost my sense of smell, I had been training to be a chef. I was in love with food. I was passionate about cooking. I wanted nothing more than to, you know, spend my life in the kitchen and feed people. But without a sense of smell, I lost flavor, basically. I had known that smell and taste were connected, but I didn't realize by how much, how powerful smell was when it came to eating and tasting. So without a sense of smell, I had the salty, sweet, bitter, sour, and umami of my taste buds on my tongue. You know, I could taste salt. I could taste sugar. I had temperature and texture, but very little else. I didn't have spice or herb, all of the nuance that makes food recognizable or good. So without a sense of smell, food became mute and bland. Everything tasted the same. It was very difficult.
It was depressing, wasn't it?
It was incredibly depressing. You know, walking into a kitchen where someone is cooking, where it would once be butter and garlic, was just flat and plain. I couldn't tell when I was hungry. I couldn't tell when food was in the kitchen, when I ate it. You know, it was like my world had gone from color to black and white.
I was particularly fascinated by one of the things that it seemed you enjoyed eating at that time that involved a familiar Louisiana ingredient and some bread.
Mm-hmm.
What was that?
Oh, Tabasco sauce. I ate it on everything because I could feel the spiciness. I mean, that's a tingling of the nerves in the mouth. I could feel that. And it made food feel more alive. So I ate Tabasco on everything.
Well, you know, I have long been an advocate about how important our taste memories are. I've often said that I believe your heartstrings are tied directly to your taste buds. But you made me realize that it does have a lot more to do with scent. Give me some examples of some things that maybe you lose memories and such as a result of this.
Oh, completely. Smell is so intricately intertwined with memories. I think we've all had experiences in which we encounter a familiar but surprising scent, and it sends us straight back to a moment when we're little. And it's usually not just a moment. It's an emotional, you know, gut-punching type of moment. Smell is very connected to memory in our brains. And so I think that translates to being in the kitchen and smelling cinnamon or nutmeg and remembering Christmas, or chicken roasting in the oven, remembering our mother's kitchen when we were little.
So, Molly, what did you do to go about regaining your sense of smell?
I was lucky. My sense of smell began to return on its own very slowly over the course of years. And the first scent returned, and it was one scent at a time. And I was chopping fresh rosemary. I was helping my mother to cook dinner, and I was chopping it for a marinade, and there was nothing. I was chopping, and then all of a sudden, the smell just hit me, and it was, you know, glorious, dark green and earthy and herby, and reminded me of a moment in my childhood, of course, when I rode a horse for the first time out west. But after that, it happened very slowly that my sense of smell returned. It was all good scents in the beginning, rosemary and chocolate, cucumbers, which I hadn't even realized had a scent before it came back. But to help my sense of smell come back, I had begun talking to scientists and perfumers, you know, trying to get answers. What was going on in my nose? Why did this mean so much? Why weren't there answers of how I could recover? And many of them told me that though it was not foolproof, smelling things would help me to retrain my sense of smell, to help get it back. And that could be just taking spices out of my cupboard and smelling them one after another. I even went so far as to go to perfume school and smell raw perfume materials over and over. And that really did help.
Do you still suffer any residual effects?
Well, I think that I can smell today better than I could before. And I'm not sure that's because I can smell more or more intensely, but simply that I pay so much attention to scent now, and smelling things and labeling things and just being aware. So I think that the only residual effects right now are good ones.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Good. Well, I'm thrilled that you were able to come and talk with us today. And I want to thank you so much. And please come back to New Orleans and have another sniff and taste of us soon.
Oh, I will. Thank you.
Molly Birnbaum, author of A Season to Taste. On August the 25th, our culinary heritage hero, farm-to-table pioneer Jim Corr, lost his battle with cancer. That sad day, chefs and farmers markets alike lost an inspirational friend. Farmer Jim Corr will be sorely missed. When I wrote the Crescent City Farmers Market cookbook, Jim contributed his farm-fresh take on the Louisiana classic, jambalaya. Crisp kale and brown rice add a healthy element to the recipe, but there's lots of traditional goodness in the smoked andouille sausage and bacon that's included in the dish. To make Jim's jambalaya, smother coarsely chopped kale with onions and garlic in a rich chicken stock. Brown the andouille and cook the bacon till it's crisp, while the brown rice cooks till it's tender. Stir all the ingredients together and top with buttered breadcrumbs. Bake the jambalaya in a 350-degree oven until the breadcrumbs are browned. Dominica chef Alon Shaya loves Jim's version of jambalaya so much he's been featuring it on his restaurant menu in a tribute to our friend. Stir up a pan in honor of Jim and raise a toast to America's hard-working farmers everywhere. For a copy of Jim's kale jambalaya recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org. Jim Corr's kale jambalaya is some of the best Louisiana Eats. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we're traveling to South Africa with market organizer Namvula Mashwai Cook.
When I came to New Orleans Jazz Festival, really that shaped my perception about the food, even though I had brought in a big, huge group of crafters to New Orleans. What really I walked away with was an incredible space when it comes to food, food waste, preparing food, seasoning food, presenting food.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee, Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, Palace Cafe, and the Bourbon House, Lights Egan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to Thomas Walsh, our associate producer and sound engineer. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.